From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Israel makes its military move on Rafah, the last Hamas redoubt in the Gaza Strip. What's the latest on the ground? Meantime, President Biden gives a speech on anti-Semitism at the Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony at the Capitol as protests continue to Royal College campuses. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, Elliot Kaufman and Kim Strassel. On Monday, Israel's military said, quote, it was conducting targeted strikes against Hamas terror targets in eastern Rafah, unquote. As of Tuesday here in the U.S., Israeli tanks have entered and taken control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. Elliot, let's start with what's happening on the ground there. Can you give us a sense of what's going on and where does Israel go from here?
Well, Israel understands that it has to fight in Rafah. If it wants to defeat Hamas, there's really no other way. Because what is in Rafah? Hamas's four military battalions, Hamas's leaders, Hamas's hostages. And so that's why Israel understood that it had to do something in the city, Hamas's final southern stronghold in Gaza. There's no victory without that. What's happening right now, Israel has advanced along the Gaza-Egyptian border, taken the southern axis of the main Gazan north-south road, and, as you said, taken the crucial Rafah crossing. Now, this is indispensable for Hamas's power over Gaza. Why is that? Because that's where aid enters into the strip. Hamas steals that aid, controls that aid, and uses it to keep its control over the population. And second, Hamas smuggles in its weapons from Egypt across that border. Israel has already uncovered four tunnels. It expects to uncover many more in that area. The question is what Israel does now. It can stop there and say, we achieved an important limited objective. It can continue across the entire Gaza-Egypt border, or it can continue and try to take the city of Rafah itself. All the while, hostage negotiations are continuing. One question for Israel is, does it want Hamas to be negotiating under fire or with relative calm?
The Biden administration, among others, had warned Israel against any sort of operation in Rafah, warning about civilians taking shelter there. And Kim, on Monday, Hamas said that it had agreed to some sort of ceasefire proposal brokered by Egypt and Qatar. But part of what is remarkable here is that Israeli political opinion seems so united on a course of action. This was the statement on Monday from the Prime Minister's office. The War Cabinet this evening unanimously decided Israel will continue its operation in Rafah in order to apply military pressure on Hamas so as to advance the release of our hostages and achieve the other objectives of the war. While the Hamas proposal is far from meeting Israel's core demands, Israel will dispatch a ranking delegation to Egypt in an effort to maximize the possibility of reaching an agreement on terms acceptable to Israel. And Kim, part of what's going on here, my understanding, is that what Hamas wanted was a permanent ceasefire, and essentially that would allow Hamas to remain in power. And Israel, the society, politicians, the war cabinet there seem determined, understandably so, not to have an ending here that results in Hamas remaining in power in Gaza.
Well, you just put your finger on that Israeli resolve, right? And the thing that is completely confounding to me is that everyone else who is now criticizing this or making warnings and saying you can't do that, what exactly did they think was going to be the end result of this once Israel said that it was going to go into Gaza with the stated aim of removing Hamas? Hamas has, as Elliot just described, now centered what's left of its resistance down there in the Rafah area. It's vital, as he noted, for them getting supplies to continue their domination. Israel has understood this from the start, that if you were going to have to go after Hamas, you were going to have to root them out wherever they were, and that at some point, they were likely to hole up somewhere and that they were going to have to go in. What is amazing is that, you know, countries like France are saying if you displace the refugees again, it will be a crime, or the United Nations getting in a twist about this, or the United States and Joe Biden putting down red lines as to what Israel can or cannot do. These are the same people that in the beginning absolutely backed Israel and its determination that it needed to go stop Hamas's ability to do this again. And this is the natural consequence of it. I would also note, I think it is important to point out that to the degree that Hamas is finally deciding that it wants to have a conversation again about hostage negotiations and a ceasefire, whether they go anywhere or not, it is because they are suddenly under threat again in Rafah, and we have seen this from them before, that they have suddenly decided to come to the table because they understand that it's their way of trying to stop what's coming at them. And I think Elliot made a great point, which is Israel's going to have to decide how much they decide to bend to that new plea from Hamas or just keep going.
Elliot, can you give us some more context on this quote-unquote ceasefire deal that Hamas announced on Monday that it would agree to? What were the terms of that, and why were they not acceptable to Israel?
So this was a brilliant Hamas information operation, because Israel had basically demonstrated to the world, and certainly to the U.S.'s satisfaction, that there was no finding a deal with Hamas. It had dragged out negotiations for months and months. Israel actually copy-pasted some of Hamas's earlier asks in the hostage deal, put that into Israel's latest hostage deal ceasefire proposal, and offered it back to Hamas. Hamas said no. So at this point, Israel said, we're going forward with Rafah. We've exhausted all other options. And so what does Hamas do in that moment? It says, we have accepted the deal. And credulous news outlets run with this for the hour leading up to Israel's entry into Rafah, that Hamas accepted the deal. It turns out Hamas did no such thing. It sent what is a counteroffer. It's done that before, and this was another counteroffer. Included in it are some terms that Israel can't really work with. For instance, with U.S. pressure, Israel has been negotiated down from accepting 40 hostages in the first phase to 33 hostages. Hamas now said, how about 33 hostages dead or alive? Meaning we would give you the bodies, but not living hostages necessarily. Well, that's not going to cut it. Another one was to get half of those 33 hostages, Israel would have to be well advanced to signing off on an abandonment of the war and also a full withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, allowing all people to return to the north of Gaza. That includes Hamas fighters, of course. So end the war, return all the territory to Hamas. Those terms aren't going to work. So negotiations will continue, but with the difference that Hamas is under military pressure in Rafah.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a minute.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. Another thing I think is worth underlining here and continuing to talk about is the fact that at least some of these hostages, several of them, is my understanding, are Americans. They're U.S. citizens, some of them born in the United States. And Hamas in recent days has been releasing videos of some of them as proof of life, purportedly. So this is a April 24th story in the L.A. Times. Nearly 7 months into the Israel-Hamas war, Hamas released a video Wednesday of California-born hostage Hirsch Goldberg Pollan. It is the first time the American-Israeli citizen who was severely injured when Hamas attacked the Nova Music Festival on October 7th has been shown alive since his capture. He's 23 years old. Kim, in the video, he's missing part of his left hand and his arm. And there was some testimony previously from survivors that he had been injured in the attack. And Kim, again, this is something that I think is easy for Americans to forget, but there are American citizens that are currently being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza.
Yeah, by some estimates, 5 Americans. And I would just point out, all of this underlines the despicability, the cruelty of Hamas and the people that we are talking about here. I mean, these hostages have now been held for more than 200 days. I would note that as this ceasefire was being discussed, that when Hamas offered those 33 hostages, now we know dead or alive, they said that they would only be talking initially about returning women, older men, and the sick and the wounded, meaning that they have kept those women and older men and the sick and the wounded for all this period of time, and goodness knows in what types of condition. I also think it's noteworthy that some of these hostage videos that Hamas has been releasing, and there has been more than one, those who watched them described those that were talking, the hostages, as being under duress, meaning that they were clearly being forced to speak and to call for an end to the war. So they're now being used as a certain degree as propaganda pieces as well from Hamas too, as they try to inflict more pressure for Israel to stand down in their operation. I think it just underlines the rightness of Israel's determination to see an end to Hamas and finish this operation, because these are not the kind of people. If these are the sort of people that are handling hostages this way, you are not going to be able to trust anything that they put forward going forward.
Let's turn to President Biden's speech on Tuesday morning. He warned of a, quote, ferocious, unquote, surge of anti-Semitism in an address at the U.S. Capitol in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. Let's listen to a piece of what Biden said.
This hatred continues to lie deep in the hearts of too many people in the world and requires our continued vigilance and outspokenness. That hatred was brought to life on October 7th in 2023 on a sacred Jewish holiday. The terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Driven by ancient desire to wipe out the Jewish people off the face of the earth.
Ellie, what did you make of President Biden's remarks? I guess I give him some credit for some moral clarity. That is the Joe Biden that we saw shortly after October 7th. But where has he been in recent weeks?
I think he said some important things, acknowledging that there has been a surge, a ferocious surge, saying that American Jews are not alone right now. He said things that people needed to hear. He also said never again means never forget, and that he will not forget October 7th. He said that his support for Israel is ironclad. The problem with saying these things is that at the very same time, we are being treated to news report after news report about how President Biden is now delaying support for Israel, delaying military aid, weapons shipments, weapons sales, and these are JDAMs, which are needed to create guided munitions, so crucial for any Israeli military operation, and also with just basic artillery munitions, tank rounds. And so you kind of have to ask the question, when he talks about this ironclad support, when he talks about lessons of the Holocaust, I mean, what lessons is he drawing? You know, sometimes in the West, I think the lesson that people draw is you should offer sympathy to the Jewish people and you should feel bad about what happened to them and in some ways what continues. In Israel, I think they take some different lessons. They take a lesson that one must fight and that there's no substitute for doing that. And I think after October 7th, the lesson they've taken is that they have to win. They can't continue living with genocidal terrorists on their border. They can't just teach those terrorists a lesson. They have to actually defeat them. And so President Biden said important things, but I'm waiting to see if that lesson hits home.
Kim, what's your read of the speech? And we'll play another clip here, add some more fodder to the conversation. President Biden also addressed the campus protests and encampments that have roiled college campuses in recent weeks. Listen to this.
In America, we respect and protect the fundamental right to free speech, to debate and disagree, to protest peacefully, and make our voices heard. I understand that's America, but there is no place on any campus in America, any place in America, for anti-Semitism or hate speech or threats of violence of any kind, whether against Jews or anyone else. Violent attacks, destroying property, is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. And we are not a lawless country. We're a civil society. We uphold the rule of law. And no one should have to hide or be brave just to be themselves.
Kim, do you think that met the moment?
I think it's moving closer. And I think it's well overdue, given all those days, weeks that President Biden was silent on this issue. And I'm glad to hear all the words that he spoke. But I would nonetheless note that there still is an element of kind of threading the needle here. Because one thing, if you listen to that speech, is it's one thing to go out and say, I feel your pain and I have solidarity with Jews and I support the security of Israel and an independent Jewish state. He said all of those things. That's good. And to also say there's no place for this or that. But that's different than actually calling out those who are doing it, criticizing them specifically, and addressing the root causes of this, which, by the way, are in part a protest of his own policies. I would just note there was a very interesting contrast there between President Biden, who spoke after House Speaker Mike Johnson at the same event. And he was much more blunt about calling out what he said was an anti-Semitic virus that was spreading across campuses because universities were allowing these areas to become hostile spaces for Jewish professors and Jewish students. And so he was much more direct in talking about universities and the general culture on university campuses that have given rise to this kind of mayhem we see going on out there. And I know it's a subtle point, but there is a difference there between that kind of pointing the finger at what exactly is the problem and Joe Biden just condemning that it's happening, which is not exactly the same thing.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
High inflation has impacted many of us. But what happens when prices go up 55, 67, or even 276%? It makes living more costly. It eats into your paycheck.
At the end of the day, the salary itself, it's not enough.
And money quickly loses value.
You can't save, you can't do anything.
Check out our complete series on extreme world inflation from A to Z from What's News, plus other exclusive content on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I have to agree with Kim here. That strikes me as the bare minimum that the President of the United States ought to say: no threats of violence, no vandalism, don't break the law. But I was hoping for a more pointed criticism of these forces on campus, Elliot. And notable that these protests continue. The headline at WBUR right now is that protesters reclaim encampment at MIT as university threatens suspension. On Monday, Columbia University announced that it would replace, that's the word in the news story, the university-wide commencement ceremony on May 15th and have smaller school-based celebrations, according to the school announcement. And Elliot, President Biden could have gone after these protesters as denying to their fellow students the education that they are paying for, the education that by right as students they ought to have. These kind of ceremonies like commencement, public spaces on campus, and so on and so forth.
You're right. And I think it's worth recognizing that the spread of these encampments, this is not a spontaneous thing, the youth of America, you know, expressing their feelings. I mean, there are very specific groups with agendas that have been well known. I mean, Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, the national group, praised October 7th, right after it happened. And they organized days of resistance in solidarity with the attack before Israel had even begun its response. This is where they are. And if you look at the adult leadership of these groups, you have overlap with members of previous organizations that were fundraising for Hamas and were shut down by U.S. law enforcement. I mean, this is a group with a chapter on every campus that has real plans for encampments, for keeping out other students, for how to deal with the media. And you're seeing sophisticated operations, student activists working with outside activists. It's not just infiltrators coming in and making it something. It's not. No, they're, you know, working toward the same purpose. And there's real planning and real money. And one problem that President Biden has is that this is part of the activist base of the Democratic Party. This is his coalition. And so does he want to condemn elements of the coalition? Does he want to go after them and actually make a difference on the campuses? If he wants to, there are options available to him. But so far, we haven't seen that.
Kim, we'll give you the last word, but let's end with a story from George Washington University. We've talked about how different campuses are handling these protests in different ways, but something fascinating is happening there in Washington, D.C. The president of GW has decried a, quote, illegal and potentially dangerous occupation of GW property. But amazingly, the Metropolitan Police in the District of Columbia are saying that they will not help clear that encampment. Here's a statement last week from the police chief, Pamela Smith. I think here in the District of Columbia, we allow people the opportunity to have freedom of speech. And that's what we're seeing right now. There has been no violence, no violent behavior, no confrontations, unquote. And so, Kim, I find that remarkable. If you have somebody camped on your front lawn, I guess, don't call the police in the District of Columbia if they're not being violent, because apparently there's no property anymore in the District of Columbia.
Apparently not. Especially, this is remarkable given that the GW president actually enumerated as well the problems that were going on in campus, the rules that were being broken, and the violations of the law, just in terms of this being private property and people being engaged in activities that the owner of that property have said are not allowed. She noted that the encampments were not lawful. She noted that these protesters had vandalized a university statue and a flag. There were anti-Semitic images and hateful rhetoric, that they were chasing people off the public square who they didn't feel had a right to be there. I mean, this is the lunatics running the asylum and the president of a university asking law enforcement to allow them to maintain or retake control and being denied. And you have to know that some of this has to do with the D.C. political environment. And Muriel Bowser of D.C., probably in solidarity with a lot of very progressive lawmakers that are not unhappy to see some of these protests going on. It could just be a demoralization among the police force. I would note that D.C. has been losing cops right and left. Last year, it had the fewest number of cops any time on its force in the past 50 years. And they certainly have a lot of other issues they're dealing with, from carjackings to murders. But I think the remarkable thing was that what was cited here was not a lack of manpower, but a lack of will and a pronouncement by the police that they would decide what was lawbreaking or not, despite all the clear evidence in front of them. We now have some of the Republicans in Congress threatening to use legislative action because they do have some sort of joint authority within the district. We will see where that goes, but this was really pretty shameful.
Thank you, Kim and Elliot. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.